The diamond is mine, my treacherous darling. And then you scoop up the diamond like this.
Sammy, no,
Hazel protested. But Sammy snatched up the stone and slipped it into his pocket in one smooth move. He wheeled on Rufus.
I want emotion. I want the ladies in the audience swooning. Ladies, did Mr. Cooper make you swoon just now?
No,
several of them called back.
There, you see, Sammy cried. Now, from the top,
he yelled into his dunce cap.
Action!
Rufus was just starting to get over his confusion. He stepped toward Sammy and said,
Valdez, I'm gonna...
The bell rang. Kids swarmed the doors. Sammy pulled Hazel out of the way as the little ones, who acted like they were on Sammy's payroll, herded Rufus along with them so he was carried inside on a tide of kindergartners. Soon Sammy and Hazel were alone except for the ghosts. Sammy scooped up Hazel's smashed lunch, made a show of dusting off the canvas bag, and presented it to her with a deep bow, as if it were her crown.
Miss Lamar.
Hazel from the past took her ruined lunch. She looked like she was about to cry, but Leo couldn't tell if that was from relief or misery or admiration.
Sammy, Rufus is going to kill you.
Ah, he knows better than to tangle with me.
Sammy plopped the dunce cap on top of his jockey cap. He stood up straight and stuck out his scrawny chest. The dunce cap fell off. Hazel laughed.
You are ridiculous.
Well, thank you, Miss Lamar.
You're welcome, my treacherous darling.
Sammy's smile wavered. The air became uncomfortably charged. Hazel stared at the ground.
You shouldn't have touched that diamond. It's dangerous.
Aw, come on, Sammy said. Not for me.
Hazel studied him warily, like she wanted to believe it.
Bad things might happen. You shouldn't.
I won't sell it, Sammy said. I promise. I'll just keep it as a token of your flavor.
Hazel forced a smile.
I think you mean token of my favor.
There you are. We should get going. It's time for our next scene. Hedy Lamar nearly dies of boredom in English class.
Sammy held out his elbow like a gentleman, but Hazel pushed him away playfully.
Thanks for being there, Sammy.
Miss Lamar, I will always be there for you, he said brightly.
The two of them raced back into the schoolhouse. Leo felt more like a ghost than ever. Maybe he had actually been an Eidolon his whole life, because this kid he'd just seen should have been the real Leo. He was smarter, cooler, and funnier. He flirted so well with Hazel that he had obviously stolen her heart. No wonder Hazel had looked at Leo so strangely when they first met. No wonder she had said Sammy with so much feeling. But Leo wasn't Sammy, any more than Flathead Rufus was Clark Gable.
Hazel, he said. I don't...
The schoolyard dissolved into a different scene. Hazel and Leo were still ghosts, but now they stood in front of a rundown house next to a drainage ditch overgrown with weeds. A clump of banana trees drooped in the yard. Perched on the steps, an old-fashioned radio played conjunto music. And on the shaded porch, sitting in a rocking chair, a skinny old man gazed at the horizon.
Where are we?
Hazel asked. She was still only vapor, but her voice was full of alarm.
This isn't from my life.
Leo felt as if his ghostly self was thickening, becoming more real. This place seemed strangely familiar.
It's Houston, he realized. I know this view. That drainage ditch. This is my mom's old neighborhood, where she grew up. Hobby Airport is over that way.
This is your life? Hazel said.
I don't understand. How? You're asking me?
Leo demanded. Suddenly the old man murmured.
Ah, Hazel.
A shock went up Leo's spine. The old man's eyes were still fixed on the horizon. How did he know they were here?
I guess we ran out of time, the old man continued dreamily. Well,
he didn't finish the thought. Hazel and Leo stayed very still. The old man made no further sign that he saw them or heard them. It dawned on Leo that the guy had been talking to himself,
But then why had he said Hazel's name? He had leathery skin, curly white hair, and gnarled hands, like he'd spent a lifetime working in a machine shop. He wore a pale yellow shirt, spotless and clean, with gray slacks and suspenders and polished black shoes. Despite his age, his eyes were sharp and clear. He sat with a kind of quiet dignity. He looked at Peace, amused even, like he was thinking, "Dang, I lived this long? Cool." Leo was pretty sure he had never seen this man before. So why did he seem familiar? Then he realized the man was tapping his fingers on the arm of his chair, but the tapping wasn't random. He was using Morse code, just like Leo's mother used to do with him. And the old man was tapping the same message. "I love you." The screen door opened. A young woman came out. She wore jeans and a turquoise blouse. Her hair was cut in a short black wedge. She was pretty, but not delicate. She had well-muscled arms and calloused hands. Like the old man's, her brown eyes glinted with amusement. In her arms was a baby wrapped in a blue blanket. "Look, mijo," she said to the baby. "This is your bisabuelo. Bisabuelo, you want to hold him?" When Leo heard her voice, he sobbed. It was his mother, younger than he remembered her, but very much alive. That meant the baby in her arms. The old man broke into a huge grin. He had perfect teeth, as white as his hair, his face crinkled with smile lines. "A boy! Mi bebito, Leo!" "Leo?" Hazel whispered. That's you? What is bisabuelo?" Leo couldn't find his voice. "Great-grandfather," he wanted to say. The old man took baby Leo in his arms, chuckling with appreciation and tickling the baby's chin. And ghost Leo finally realized what he was seeing. Somehow, Hazel's power to revisit the past had found the one event that connected both of their lives, where Leo's timeline touched Hazel's. This old man. "Oh." Hazel seemed to realize who he was at the same moment. Her voice became very small, on the verge of tears.
"Oh, Sammy, no."
"Ah, little Leo," said Sammy Valdez, aged well into his 70s. "You'll have to be my stunt double, eh? That's what they call it, I think. Tell her for me. I hoped I would be alive, but the curse won't have it." Hazel sobbed.
Gia told me that he died of a heart attack in the 1960s. But this can't be." Sammy Valdez kept talking to the baby while Leo's mother, Esperanza, looked on with a pained smile. Perhaps a little worried that Leo's bisabuelo was rambling. A little sad that he was speaking nonsense.
"That lady, Doña Caída, she warned me."
Sammy shook his head sadly.
"She said Hazel's great danger would not happen in my lifetime. But I promised I would be there for her. You will have to tell her I'm sorry, Leo. Help her if you can."
"Bisabuelo," Esperanza said, "you must be tired." She extended her arms to take the baby, but the old man cuddled him a moment longer. Baby Leo seemed perfectly fine with it.
"Tell her I'm sorry I sold the diamond, eh?" Sammy said. "I broke my promise. When she disappeared in Alaska. Ah, so long ago. I finally used that diamond, moved to Texas as I always dreamed. Started my machine shop. Started my family. It was a good life. But Hazel was right. The diamond came with a curse. I never saw her again."
"Oh, Sammy," Hazel said. "No, a curse didn't keep me away. I wanted to come back. I died." The old man didn't seem to hear. He smiled down at the baby and kissed him on the head.
"I give you my blessing, Leo. First male great-grandchild. I have a feeling you are special, like Hazel was. You are more than a regular baby, eh? You will carry on for me. You will see her someday. Tell her hello for me."
"Bisabuelo," Esperanza said, a little more insistently.
Yes, yes, Sammy chuckled. El viejo loco rambles on. I am tired, Esperanza. You are right, but I'll rest soon. Spend a good life. Raise him well, Nienta.
The scene faded. Leo is standing on the deck of the Argo II holding Hazel's hand. The sun had gone down, and the ship was lit only by bronze lanterns. Hazel's eyes were puffy from crying. What they'd seen was too much. The whole ocean heaved under them, and now for the first time Leo felt as if they were totally adrift.
Hello, Hazel Avesk, he said, his voice gravelly.
Her chin trembled. She turned away and opened her mouth to speak, but before she could, the ship lurched to one side.
Leo! Coach Hedge yelled. Festus whirred in alarm and blew flames into the night sky. The ship's bell rang.
Those monsters you were worried about, Hedge shouted. One of them found us!
Chapter 23. Leo. Leo deserved a dunce cap. If he'd been thinking straight, he would have switched the ship's detection system from radar to sonar as soon as they left Charleston Harbor. That's what he had forgotten. He designed the hull to resonate every few seconds, sending waves through the mist and alerting Festus to any nearby monsters. But it only worked in one mode at a time, water or air. He'd been so rattled by the Romans, then the storm, then Hazel, that he had completely forgotten. Now, a monster was right underneath them. The ship tilted to starboard. Hazel gripped the rigging.
Hedge yelled, Valdez! Which button blows up monsters? Take the helm!
Leo climbed the tilting deck and managed to grab the port rail. He started clambering sideways toward the helm, but when he saw the monster surface, he forgot how to move. The thing was the length of their ship. In the moonlight, it looked like a cross between a giant shrimp and a cockroach, with a pink chitinous shell, a flat crayfish tail, and millipede-type legs undulating hypnotically as the monster scraped against the hull of the Argo II. Its head surfaced last, the slimy pink face of an enormous catfish with glassy dead eyes, a gaping toothless maw, and a forest of tentacles sprouting from each nostril, making the bushiest nose beard Leo had ever had the displeasure to behold. Leo remembered special Friday night dinners he and his mom used to share at a local seafood restaurant in Houston. They would eat shrimp and catfish. The idea now made him want to throw up.
Come on, Valdez, Hedge yelled. Take the wheel so I can get my baseball bat.
A bat's not going to help, Leo said,
but he made his way toward the helm. Behind him, the rest of his friends stumbled up the stairs. Percy yelled,
What's going on?
Gah! Shrimpzilla!
Frank ran to Hazel's side. She was clutching the rigging, still dazed from her flashback, but she gestured that she was all right. The monster rammed the ship again. The hull groaned. Annabeth, Piper, and Jason tumbled to starboard and almost rolled overboard. Leo reached the helm. His hands flew across the controls. Over the intercom, Festus clacked and clicked about leaks below decks. But the ship didn't seem to be in danger of sinking. At least not yet. Leo toggled the oars. They could convert into spears, which should be enough to drive the creature away. Unfortunately, they were jammed. Shrimpzilla must have knocked them out of alignment, and the monster was in spitting distance, which meant that Leo couldn't use the ballistae without setting the Argo II on fire as well.
How did it get so close?
Annabeth shouted, pulling herself up on one of the rail shields.
I don't know,
Hedge snarled. He looked around for his bat, which had rolled across the quarterdeck.
I'm stupid, Leo scolded himself. Stupid, stupid. I forgot the sonar.
The ship tilted farther to starboard. Either the monster was trying to give them a hug, or it was about to capsize them.
Sonar?
Hedge demanded.
Pan's pipes, Valdez! Maybe if you hadn't been staring into Hazel's eyes, holding hands for so long.
What?
Frank yelped.
It wasn't like that, Hazel protested.
It doesn't matter, Piper said. Jason, can you call some lightning?
Jason struggled to his feet. He only managed to shake his head. Summoning the storm earlier had taken too much out of him.
Leo doubted the poor guy could pop a spark plug in the shape he was in.
Percy, Annabeth said, can you talk to that thing? Do you know what it is?
The son of the sea god shook his head, clearly mystified.
Maybe it's just curious about the ship. Maybe...
The monster's tendrils lashed across the deck so fast, Leo didn't even have time to yell,
Look out!
One slammed Percy in the chest and sent him crashing down the steps. Another wrapped around Piper's legs and dragged her, screaming, toward the rail. Dozens more tendrils curled around the masts, encircling the crossbows and ripping down the rigging.
Nose hair attack!
Hedge snatched up his bat and leaped into action. But his hits just bounced harmlessly off the tendrils. Jason drew his sword. He tried to free Piper, but he was still weak. His gold blade cut through the tendrils with no problem, but faster than he could sever them, more took their place. Annabeth unsheathed her dagger. She ran through the forest of tentacles, dodging and stabbing at whatever target she could find. Frank pulled out his bow. He fired over the side at the creature's body, lodging arrows in the chinks of its shell. But that only seemed to annoy the monster. It bellowed and rocked the ship. The mast creaked like it might snap off. They needed more firepower, but they couldn't use ballistae. They needed to deliver a blast that wouldn't destroy the ship. But how? Leo's eyes fixed on a supply crate next to Hazel's feet.
Hazel! He yelled. That box! Open it!
She hesitated, then saw the box he meant. The label read, Warning, do not open.
Open it! Leo yelled again. Coach, take the wheel! Turn us toward the monster, or we'll capsize!
Hedge danced through the tentacles with his nimble goat hooves, smashing away with gusto. He bounded toward the helm and took the controls.
Hope you got a plan, he shouted.
A bad one,
Leo raced toward the mast. The monster pushed against the Argo II. The deck lurched to 45 degrees. Despite everyone's efforts, the tentacles were just too numerous to fight. They seemed able to elongate as much as they wanted. Soon they'd have the Argo II completely entangled. Percy hadn't appeared from below. The others were fighting for their lives against nose hair.
Frank!
Leo called as he ran toward Hazel.
Buy us some time! Can you turn into a shark or something?
Frank glanced over, scowling, and in that moment, a tentacle slammed into the big guy, knocking him overboard. Hazel screamed. She'd opened the supply box and almost dropped the two glass vials she was holding. Leo caught them. Each was the size of an apple, and the liquid inside glowed poisonous green. The glass was warm to the touch. Leo's chest felt like it might implode from guilt. He'd just distracted Frank and possibly gotten him killed, but he couldn't think about it. He had to save the ship.
Come on!
He handed Hazel one of the vials.
We can kill the monster and save Frank!
He hoped he wasn't lying. Getting to the port rail was more like rock climbing than walking, but finally they made it.
What is this stuff?
Hazel gasped, cradling her glass vial.
Greek fire!
Her eyes widened.
Are you crazy? If these break, we'll burn the whole ship! Its mouth,
Leo said.
Just chuck it down its...
Suddenly, Leo was crushed against Hazel, and the world turned sideways. As they were lifted into the air, he realized they'd been wrapped together in a tentacle. Leo's arms were free, but it was all he could do to keep hold of his Greek fire vial. Hazel struggled. Her arms were pinned, which meant at any moment the vial trapped between them might break. And that would be extremely bad for their health. They rose 10 feet, 20 feet, 30 feet above the monster. Leo caught a glimpse of his friends in a losing battle, yelling and slashing at the monster's nose hairs. He saw Coach Hedge struggling to keep the ship from capsizing. The sea was dark, but in the moonlight, he thought he saw a glistening object floating near the monster. Maybe the unconscious body of Frank Jong.
Leo!
Hazel gasped.
I can't. My arms.
Hazel, he said.
Do you trust me?
No.
Me neither,
Leo admitted.
When this thing drops us, hold your breath. Whatever you do, try to chuck your vial as far away from the ship as possible.
Why? Why would it drop us?
Leo stared down at the monster's head. This would be a tough shot, but he had no choice.
He raised the vial in his left hand. He pressed his right hand against the tentacle and summoned fire to his palm. A narrowly focused, white-hot burst. That got the creature's attention. A tremble went all the way down the tentacle as its flesh blistered under Leo's touch. The monster raised its maw, bellowing in pain, and Leo threw his Greek fire straight down its throat. After that, things got fuzzy. Leo felt the tentacle release them. They fell. He heard a muffled explosion and saw a green flash of light inside the giant pink lampshade of the monster's body. The water hit Leo's face like a brick wrapped in sandpaper, and he sank into darkness. He clamped his mouth shut, trying not to breathe, but he could feel himself losing consciousness. Through the sting of the salt water, he thought he saw the hazy silhouette of the ship's hull above. A dark oval surrounded by a green fiery corona, but he couldn't tell if the ship was actually on fire. Killed by a giant shrimp, Leo thought bitterly.
At least let the Argo II survive. Let my friends be okay.
His vision began to dim. His lungs burned. Just as he was about to give up, a strange face hovered over him. A man who looked like Chiron, their trainer back at Camp Half-Blood. He had the same curly hair, shaggy beard, and intelligent eyes. A look somewhere between wild hippie and fatherly professor. Except this man's skin was the color of a lima bean. The man silently held up a dagger. His expression was grim and reproachful, as if to say, "Now hold still, or I can't kill you properly." Leo blacked out. When Leo woke, he wondered if he was a ghost in another flashback, because he was floating weightlessly. His eyes slowly adjusted to the dim light.
"About time."
Frank's voice had too much reverb, like he was speaking through several layers of plastic wrap. Leo sat up. Or rather, he drifted upright. He was underwater in a cave about the size of a two-car garage. Phosphorescent moss covered the ceiling, bathing the room in a blue and green glow. The floor was a carpet of sea urchins, which would have been uncomfortable to walk on, so Leo was glad he was floating. He didn't understand how he could be breathing with no air. Frank levitated nearby in meditation position. With his chubby face and his grumpy expression, he looked like a Buddha who'd achieved enlightenment and wasn't thrilled about it. The only exit to the cave was blocked by a massive abalone shell, its surface glistening in pearl and rose and turquoise. If this cave was a prison, at least it had an awesome door.
"Where are we?" Leo asked. "Where is everyone else?"
"Everyone?" Frank grumbled. "I don't know. As far as I can tell, it's just you and me and Hazel down here. The fish horse guys took Hazel about an hour ago, leaving me with you."
Frank's tone made it obvious he didn't approve of those arrangements. He didn't look injured, but Leo realized that he no longer had his bow or quiver. In a panic, Leo patted his waist. His tool belt was gone.
"They searched us," Frank said. "Took anything that could be a weapon."
"Who?"
Leo demanded.
"Who are these fish horse?"
"Fish horse guys," Frank clarified,
which wasn't very clear.
"They must have grabbed us when we fell in the ocean and dragged us wherever this is."
Leo remembered the last thing he'd seen before he passed out, the lima bean-colored face of the bearded man with the dagger.
"A shrimp monster. The Argo II, is the ship okay?"
"I don't know," Frank said darkly. "The others might be in trouble, or hurt, or worse. But I guess you care more about your ship than your friends."
Leo felt like his face had just hit the water again.
"What kind of stupid thing?"
Then he realized why Frank was so angry. The flashback. Things had happened so fast with the monster attack, Leo had almost forgotten. Coach Hedge had made that stupid comment about Leo and Hazel holding hands and gazing into each other's eyes. It probably hadn't helped that Leo had gotten Frank knocked overboard right after that. Suddenly, Leo found it hard to meet Frank's gaze.
"Look, man, I'm sorry I got us into this mess. I totally jacked things up."
He took a deep breath, which felt surprisingly normal, considering he was underwater.
"Me and Hazel holding hands?
It's not what you think. She was showing me this flashback from her past, trying to figure out my connection with Sammy.
Frank's angry expression started to unknot, replaced by curiosity.
Did you figure it out?
Yeah, Leo said. Well, sort of. We didn't get a chance to talk about it afterwards because of Shrimpzilla, but Sammy was my great-grandfather.
He told Frank what they'd seen. The weirdness hadn't fully registered yet, but now, trying to explain it aloud, Leo could hardly believe it. Hazel had been sweet on his bisabuelo, a guy who had died when Leo was a baby. Leo hadn't made the connection before, but he had a vague memory of older family members calling his grandfather Sam Jr., which meant Sam Sr. was Sammy, Leo's bisabuelo. At some point, Tia Caída, Hera herself, had talked with Sammy, consoling him and giving him a glimpse into the future, which meant that Hera had been shaping Leo's life generations before he was even born. If Hazel had stayed in the 1940s, if she'd married Sammy, Leo might have been her great-grandson.
Oh, man, Leo said when he had finished the story. I don't feel so good. But I swear on the sticks, that's what we saw.
Frank had the same expression as the monster catfish head, wide glassy eyes and an open mouth.
Hazel? Hazel liked your great-grandfather? That's why she likes you?
Frank, I know this is weird, believe me, but I don't like Hazel. Not that way. I'm not moving in on your girl.
Frank knit his eyebrows.
No?
Leo hoped he wasn't blushing. Truthfully, he had no idea how he felt about Hazel. She was awesome and cute, and Leo had a weakness for awesome, cute girls. But the flashback had complicated his feelings a lot. Besides, his ship was in trouble.
I guess you care more about your ship than your friends, Frank had said.
That wasn't true, was it? Leo's dad, Hephaestus, had admitted once that he wasn't good with organic life forms. And yes, Leo had always been more comfortable with machines than people. But he did care about his friends, Piper and Jason. He'd known them the longest, but the others were important to him too. Even Frank. They were like family. The problem was, it had been so long since Leo had had a family, he couldn't even remember how it felt. Sure, last winter he'd become senior counselor of Hephaestus' cabin, but most of his time had been spent building the ship. He liked his cabin mates. He knew how to work with them. But did he really know them? If Leo had a family, it was the demigods on the Argo II, and maybe Coach Hedge, which Leo would never admit aloud.
You will always be the outsider, warned Nemesis's voice.
But Leo tried to push that thought aside.
Right, so, he looked around him. We need to make a plan. How are we breathing? If we're under the ocean, shouldn't we be crushed by the water pressure?
Frank shrugged.
Fish horse magic, I guess. I remember the green guy touching my head with the point of a dagger. Then I could breathe.
Leo studied the abalone door.
Can you bust us out? Turn into a hammerhead shark or something?
Frank shook his head glumly.
My shape-shifting doesn't work. I don't know why. Maybe they cursed me. Or maybe I'm too messed up to focus.
Hazel could be in trouble, Leo said. We've got to get out of here.
He swam to the door and ran his fingers along the abalone. He couldn't feel any kind of latch or other mechanism. Either the door could only be opened by magic or sheer force was required, neither of which was Leo's specialty.
I've already tried, Frank said. Even if we get out, we have no weapons.
Hmm.
Leo held up his hand.
I wonder.
He concentrated, and fire flickered over his fingers. For a split second, Leo was excited, because he hadn't expected it to work underwater. Then his plan started working a little too well. Fire raced up his arm and over his body until he was completely shrouded in a thin veil of flame. He tried to breathe, but he was inhaling pure heat.
Leo!
Frank flailed backward like he was falling off a bar stool. Instead of racing to Leo's aid, he hugged the wall to get as far away as possible. Leo forced himself to stay calm. He understood what was going on. The fire itself couldn't hurt him. He willed the flames to die and counted to five. He took a shallow breath. He had oxygen again. Frank stopped trying to merge with the cave wall.
You're okay?
Yeah, Leo grumbled. Thanks for the assist.
I'm sorry.
Frank looked so horrified and ashamed it was hard for Leo to stay mad at him.
What happened?
Clever magic, Leo said. There's a thin layer of oxygen around us. Like an extra skin. Must be self-regenerating. That's how we're breathing and staying dry. The oxygen gave the fire fuel. Except the fire also suffocated me.
I really don't, Frank gulped. I don't like that fire summoning you do.
He started getting cozy with the wall again. Leo didn't mean to, but he couldn't help laughing.
Man, I'm not going to attack you.
Fire,
Frank repeated. Like that one word explained everything. Leo remembered what Hazel had said, that his fire made Frank nervous. He'd seen the discomfort in Frank's face before, but Leo hadn't taken it seriously. Frank seemed way more powerful and scary than Leo was. Now it occurred to him that Frank might have had a bad experience with fire. Leo's own mom had died in a machine shop blaze. Leo had been blamed for it. He'd grown up being called a freak, an arsonist, because whenever he got angry, things burned.
Sorry I laughed, he said, and he meant it. My mom died in a fire. I understand being afraid of it. Did something like that happen with you?
Frank seemed to be weighing how much to say.
My house. My grandmother's place. It burned down. But it's more than that.
He stared at the sea urchins on the floor.
Annabeth said I could trust the crew. Even you.
Even me, huh?
Leo wondered how that had come up in conversation.
Wow, high praise.
My weakness,
Frank started, like the words cut his mouth.
There's this piece of firewood.
The abalone door rolled open. Leo turned and found himself face to face with Lima Bean Man, who wasn't actually a man at all. Now that Leo could see him clearly, the guy was by far the weirdest creature he'd ever met, and that was saying a lot. From the waist up, he was more or less human. A thin, bare-chested dude with a dagger in his belt and a band of seashells strapped across his chest like a bandolier. His skin was green, his beard scraggly brown, and his longish hair was tied back in a seaweed bandana. A pair of lobster claws stuck up from his head like horns, turning and snapping at random. Leo decided he didn't look so much like Chiron. He looked more like the poster Leo's mom used to keep in her workspace, that old Mexican bandit Pancho Villa, except with seashells and lobster horns. From the waist down, the guy was more complicated. He had the four legs of a blue-green horse, sort of like a centaur, but toward the back his horse body morphed into a long, fishy tail about 10 feet long, with a rainbow-colored V-shaped tail fin. Now Leo understood what Frank meant about fish-horse guys.
I am Bythos, said the green man. I will interrogate Frank John.
His voice was calm and firm, leaving no room for debate.
Why did you capture us? Leo demanded. Where's Hazel?
Bythos narrowed his eyes. His expression seemed to say, did this tiny creature just talk to me?
You, Leo Valdez, will go with my brother.
Your brother?
Leo realized that a much larger figure was looming behind Bythos, with a shadow so wide it filled the entire cave entrance.
Yes, Bythos said with a dry smile. Try not to make Aphros mad.
Chapter 24. Leo. Aphros looked like his brother, except he was blue instead of green, and much, much bigger. He had Arnold as Terminator abs and arms, and a square, brutish head. A huge Conan-approved sword was strapped across his back, Even his hair was bigger, a massive globe of blue-black frizz so thick that his lobster claw horns appeared to be drowning as they tried to swim their way to the surface.
"Is that why they named you Afros?" Leo asked as they glided down the path from the cave. "Because of the Afro?"
Afro scowled.
"What do you mean?"
"Nothing,"
Leo said quickly. At least he would never have trouble remembering which fish dude was which.
"So what are you guys, exactly?"
"Ichthyocentaurs,"
Afro said, like it was a question he was tired of answering.
Icky what?
"Fish centaurs. We are the half-brothers of Chiron."
"Oh, he's a friend of mine."
Afro's narrowed his eyes.
"The one called Hazel told us this, but we will determine the truth. Come."
Leo didn't like the sound of "determine the truth." It made him think of torture racks and red-hot pokers. He followed the fish centaur through a massive forest of kelp. Leo could have darted to one side and gotten lost in the plants pretty easily, but he didn't try. For one thing, he figured Afros could travel much faster in the water, and the guy might be able to shut off the magic that let Leo move and breathe. Inside or outside the cave, Leo was just as much a captive. Also, Leo had no clue where he was. They drifted between rows of kelp as tall as apartment buildings. The green and yellow plants swayed weightlessly, like columns of helium balloons. High above, Leo saw a smudge of white that might have been the sun. He guessed that meant they'd been here overnight. Was the Argo II all right? Had it sailed on without them, or were their friends still searching? Leo couldn't even be sure how deep they were. Plants could grow here, so not too deep, right? Still, he knew he couldn't just swim for the surface. He heard about people who ascended too quickly and developed nitrogen bubbles in their blood. Leo wanted to avoid carbonated blood. They drifted along for maybe half a mile. Leo was tempted to ask where Afros was taking him, but the big sword strapped to the centaur's back sort of discouraged conversation. Finally, the kelp forest opened up. Leo gasped. They were standing, swimming, whatever, at the summit of a high underwater hill. Below them stretched an entire town of Greek-style buildings on the seafloor. The roofs were tiled with mother-of-pearl. The gardens were filled with coral and sea anemones. Hippocampi grazed in a field of seaweed. A team of cyclopes was placing the domed roof on a new temple, using a blue whale as a crane. And swimming through the streets, hanging out in the courtyards, practicing combat with tridents and swords in arena, were dozens of mermen and mermaids. Honest to goodness, fish people. Leo had seen a lot of crazy stuff, but he had always thought merpeople were silly fictional creatures, like Smurfs or Muppets. There was nothing silly or cute about these merpeople, though. Even from a distance, they looked fierce and not at all human. Their eyes glowed yellow. They had shark-like teeth and leathery skin in colors ranging from coral red to ink black.
"It's a training camp," Leo realized.
He looked at Afros in awe.
"You train heroes? The same way Chiron does?"
Afros nodded, a glint of pride in his eyes.
"We have trained all the famous mer heroes. Name a mer hero, and we have trained him or her."
"Oh, sure," Leo said. "Like, the Little Mermaid?"
Afros frowned.
"Who? No, like Triton, Glaucus, Weissmuller, and Bill."
"Oh."
Leo had no idea who any of those people were.
"You trained Bill. Impressive."
"Indeed," Afros pounded his chest. "I trained Bill myself. A great merman."
"You teach combat, I guess."
Afros threw up his hands in exasperation.
"Why does everyone assume that?"
Leo glanced at the massive sword on the fish guy's back.
I don't know."
"I teach music and poetry," Afro said. "Life skills, homemaking. These are important for heroes."
"Absolutely."
Leo tried to keep a straight face,
Sewing? Cookie baking?
Yes, I'm glad you understand. Perhaps later, if I don't have to kill you, I will share my brownie recipe.
Afros gestured behind him contemptuously.
My brother Bythos, he teaches combat.
Leo wasn't sure whether he felt relieved or insulted that the combat trainer was interrogating Frank, while Leo got the home economics teacher.
So great. This is camp... what do you call it? Camp Fishblood?
Afros frowned.
I hope that was a joke.
This is camp...
he made a sound that was a series of sonar pings and hisses.
Silly me, Leo said. And you know, I could really go for some of those brownies. So what do we have to do to get to the not killing me stage?
Tell me your story, Afro said.
Leo hesitated, but not for long. Somehow he sensed that he should tell the truth. He started at the beginning, how Hera had been his babysitter and placed him in the flames. How his mother had died because of Gia, who had identified Leo as a future enemy. He talked about how he had spent his childhood bouncing around in foster homes, until he and Jason and Piper had been taken to Camp Half-Blood. He explained the prophecy of Seven, the building of the Argo II, and their quest to reach Greece and defeat the giants before Gia woke. As he talked, Afros drew some wicked-looking metal spikes from his belt. Leo was afraid he had said something wrong, but Afros pulled some seaweed yarn from his pouch and started knitting.
Go on, he urged. Don't stop.
By the time Leo had explained the Eidolons, the problem with the Romans, and all the troubles the Argo II had encountered crossing the United States and embarking from Charleston, Afros had knitted a complete baby bonnet. Leo waited while the fish centaur put away his supplies. Afros's lobster claw horns kept swimming around in his thick hair, and Leo had to resist the urge to try to rescue them.
Very well, Afros said. I believe you.
As simple as that?
I am quite good at discerning lies. I hear none from you. Your story also fits with what Hazel Avesk told us.
Is she?
Of course, Afros said. She's fine.
He put his fingers to his mouth and whistled, which sounded strange underwater, like a dolphin screaming.
My people will bring her here shortly. You must understand our location is a carefully guarded secret. You and your friend showed up in a warship pursued by one of Keto's sea monsters. We did not know whose side you were on.
Is the ship all right?
Damaged, Afro said, but not terribly. The Scolopendra withdrew after it got a mouthful of fire. Nice touch.
Thank you. Scolopendra? Never heard of it.
Consider yourself lucky. They are nasty creatures.
Keto must really hate you.
At any rate, we rescued you and the other two from the creature's tentacles as it retreated into the deep. Your friends are still above searching for you, but we have obscured their vision. We had to be sure you were not a threat. Otherwise, we would have had to take measures.
Leo gulped. He was pretty sure taking measures did not mean baking extra brownies. And if these guys were so powerful that they could keep their camp hidden from Percy, who had all those Poseidonish water powers, they were not fish dudes to mess with.
So, we can go?
Soon, Afros promised. I must check with Bythos. When he's done talking with your friend Gank.
Frank.
Frank. When they are done, we will send you back to your ship, and we may have some warnings for you.
Warnings?
Ah,
Afros pointed. Hazel emerged from the kelp forest, escorted by two vicious-looking mermaids who were baring their fangs and hissing. Leo thought Hazel might be in danger, then he saw she was completely at ease, grinning and talking with her escorts, and Leo realized that the mermaids were laughing.
Leo!
Hazel paddled toward him.
Isn't this place amazing?
They were left alone at the ridge, which must have meant Afros really did trust them. While the centaur and the mermaids went off to fetch Frank, Leo and Hazel floated above the hill and gazed down at the underwater camp. Hazel told him how the mermaids had warmed up to her right away,
Aphros and Bythos had been fascinated by her story, as they had never met a child of Pluto before. On top of that, they had heard many legends about the horse, Orion, and they were amazed that Hazel had befriended him. Hazel had promised to visit again with Orion. The mermaids had written their phone numbers in waterproof ink on Hazel's arm so that she could keep in touch. Leo didn't even want to ask how mermaids got cell phone coverage in the middle of the Atlantic. As Hazel talked, her hair floated around her face in a cloud, like brown earth and gold dust in a miner's pan. She looked very sure of herself and very beautiful, not at all like the shy, nervous girl in that New Orleans schoolyard with her smashed canvas lunch bag at her feet.
"We didn't get to talk," Leo said.
He was reluctant to bring up the subject, but he knew this might be their only chance to be alone.
"I mean about Sammy."
Her smile faded.
"I know. I just need some time to let it sink in. It's strange to think that you and he..."
She didn't need to finish the thought. Leo knew exactly how strange it was.
"I'm not sure I can explain this to Frank," she added, "about you and me holding hands."
She wouldn't meet Leo's eyes. Down in the valley, the Cyclopes work crew cheered as the temple roof was set in place.
"I talked to him," Leo said. "I told him I wasn't trying to, you know, make trouble between you two."
"Oh, good."
Did she sound disappointed? Leo wasn't sure, and he wasn't sure he wanted to know.
"Frank, seemed pretty freaked out when I summoned fire."
Leo explained what had happened in the cave. Hazel looked stunned.
"Oh no, that would terrify him."
Her hand went to her denim jacket like she was checking for something in the inside pocket. She always wore that jacket, or some sort of overshirt, even when it was hot outside. Leo had assumed that she did it out of modesty, or because it was better for horseback riding, like a motorcycle jacket. Now he began to wonder. His brain shifted into high gear. He remembered what Frank had said about his weakness, a piece of firewood. He thought about why this kid would have a fear of fire, and why Hazel would be so attuned to those feelings. Leo thought about some of the stories he'd heard at Camp Half-Blood. For obvious reasons, he tended to pay attention to legends about fire. Now he remembered one he hadn't thought about in months.
"There was an old legend about a hero," he recalled. "His lifeline was tied to a stick in a fireplace. And when that piece of wood burned up..."
Hazel's expression turned dark. Leo knew he'd struck on the truth.
"Frank has that problem," he guessed. "And a piece of firewood..."
He pointed at Hazel's jacket.
"He gave it to you for safekeeping?"
"Leo, please don't. I can't talk about it."
Leo's instincts as a mechanic kicked in. He started thinking about the properties of wood and the corrosiveness of salt water.
"Is the firewood okay in the ocean like this? Does the layer of air around you protect it?"
"It's fine," Hazel said. "The wood didn't even get wet. Besides, it's wrapped up in several layers of cloth and plastic and..."
She bit her lip in frustration.
"And I'm not supposed to talk about it. Leo, the point is, if Frank seems afraid of you or uneasy, you've got to understand."
Leo was glad he was floating because he probably would have been too dizzy to stand. He imagined being in Frank's position, his life so fragile, it literally could burn up at any time. He imagined how much trust it would take to give his lifeline, his entire fate, to another person. Frank had chosen Hazel, obviously, so when he had seen Leo, a guy who could summon fire at will, moving in on his girl, Leo shuddered. No wonder Frank didn't like him. And suddenly Frank's ability to turn into a bunch of different animals didn't seem so awesome. Not if it came with a big catch like that. Leo thought about his least favorite line in the Prophecy of Seven. "To storm or fire, the world must fall." For a long time, he'd figured that Jason or Percy stood for storm. Maybe both of them together. Leo was the fire guy. Nobody said that, but it was pretty clear. Leo was one of the wild cards. If he did the wrong thing, the world could fall. No, it must fall.
Leo wondered if Frank and his firewood had something to do with that line. Leo had already made some epic mistakes. It would be so easy for him to accidentally send Frank Jong up in flames.
There you are,
Bythos's voice made Leo flinch. Bythos and Aphros floated over with Frank between them, looking pale but okay. Frank studied Hazel and Leo carefully, as if trying to read what they'd been talking about.
You were free to go, Bythos said.
He opened his saddlebags and returned their confiscated supplies. Leo had never been so glad to fit his tool belt around his waist.
Tell Percy Jackson not to worry, Aphros said. We have understood your story about the imprisoned sea creatures in Atlanta. Keto and Phorcys must be stopped. We will send a quest of mer heroes to defeat them and free their captives. Perhaps Cyrus. Or Bill,
Bythos offered.
Yes, Bill would be perfect, Aphros agreed. At any rate, we are grateful that Percy brought this to our attention.
You should talk to him in person, Leo suggested. I mean, son of Poseidon and all.
Both fish centaurs shook their heads solemnly.
Sometimes it is best not to interact with Poseidon's brood, Aphros said. We are friendly with the sea god, of course. But the politics of undersea deities is complicated, and we value our independence. Nevertheless, tell Percy thank you. We will do what we can to speed you safely across the Atlantic without further interference from Keto's monsters. But be warned, in the ancient sea, the Mare Nostrum, more dangers await.
Frank sighed. Naturally. Bythos clapped the big guy on the shoulder.
You will be fine, Frank Jong. Keep practicing those sea life transformations. The koi fish is good, but try for a Portuguese man of war. Remember what I showed you. It's all in the breathing.
Frank looked mortally embarrassed. Leo bit his lip, determined not to smile.
And you, Hazel, Aphros said, come visit again and bring that horse of yours. I know you were concerned about the time you lost, spending the night in our realm. You are worried about your brother Nico.
Hazel gripped her cavalry sword.
Is he... Do you know where he is?
Aphros shook his head.
Not exactly. But when you get closer, you should be able to sense his presence. Never fear. You must reach Rome the day after tomorrow if you are to save him. But there is still time. And you must save him.
Yes, Bythos agreed. He will be essential for your journey. I am not sure how, but I sense it is true.
Aphros planted his hand on Leo's shoulder.
As for you, Leo Valdez, stay close to Hazel and Frank when you reach Rome. I sense they will face, mechanical difficulties that only you can overcome.
Mechanical difficulties? Leo asked.
Aphros smiled as if that was great news.
And I have gifts for you, the brave navigator of the Argo II.
I'd like to think of myself as captain, Leo said. Or supreme commander.
Brownies!
Aphros said proudly, shoving an old-fashioned picnic basket into Leo's arms. It was surrounded by a bubble of air, which Leo hoped would keep the brownies from turning into saltwater fudge sludge.
In this basket you will also find a recipe. Not too much butter. That's the trick, and I've given you a letter of introduction to Tiberinus, the god of the Tiber River. Once you reach Rome, your friend the daughter of Athena will need this.
Annabeth, Leo said. Okay, but why?
Bythos laughed.
She follows the mark of Athena, doesn't she? Tiberinus can guide her in this quest. He's an ancient proud god who can be... difficult, but letters of introduction are everything to Roman spirits. This will convince Tiberinus to help her. Hopefully.
Hopefully, Leo repeated.
Bythos produced three small pink pearls from his saddlebags.
And now, off with you, demigods. Good sailing.
He threw a pearl at each of them in turn, and three shimmering pink bubbles of energy formed around them. They began to rise through the water. Leo just had time to think, a hamster ball elevator? Then he gained speed and rocketed toward the distant glow of the sun above. Chapter 25. Piper. Piper had a new entry in her top 10 list of times Piper felt useless. Fighting Shrimpzilla with a dagger and a pretty voice? Not so effective. Then the monster had sunk into the deep and disappeared along with three of her friends, and she'd been powerless to help them. Afterward, Annabeth, Coach Hedge, and Buford the Table rushed around repairing things so that the ship wouldn't sink. Percy, despite being exhausted, searched the ocean for their missing friends. Jason, also exhausted, flew around the rigging like a blonde Peter Pan, putting out fires from the second green explosion that had lit up the sky just above the main mast. As for Piper, all she could do was stare at her knife, Catoptris, trying to locate Leo, Hazel, and Frank. The only images that came to her were ones she didn't want to see. Three black SUVs driving north from Charleston, packed with Roman demigods. Reyna sitting at the wheel of the lead car. Giant eagles escorted them from above. Every so often, glowing purple spirits in ghostly chariots appeared out of the countryside and fell in behind them, thundering up I-95 toward New York and Camp Half-Blood. Piper concentrated harder. She saw the nightmarish images she had seen before. The human-headed bull rising from the water, then the dark, well-shaped room filling with black water as Jason, Percy, and she struggled to stay afloat. She sheathed Catoptris, wondering how Helen of Troy had stayed sane during the Trojan War, if this blade had been her only source of news. Then she remembered that everyone around Helen had been slaughtered by the invading Greek army. Maybe she hadn't stayed sane. By the time the sun rose, none of them had slept. Percy had scoured the seafloor and found nothing. The Argo, too, was no longer in danger of sinking, though without Leo, they couldn't do full repairs. The ship was capable of sailing, but no one suggested leaving the area, not without their missing friends. Piper and Annabeth sent a dream vision to Camp Half-Blood, warning Chiron of what had happened with the Romans at Fort Sumter. Annabeth explained her exchange of words with Reyna. Piper relayed the vision from her knife about the SUVs racing north. The kindly centaur's face seemed to age 30 years during the course of their conversation, but he assured them he would see to the defenses of the camp. Tyson, Mrs. O'Leary, and Ella had arrived safely. If necessary, Tyson could summon an army of Cyclopes to the camp's defense. And Ella and Rachel Dare were already comparing prophecies, trying to learn more about what the future held. The job of the seven demigods aboard the Argo II, Chiron reminded them, was to finish the quest and come back safely. After the Iris message, the demigods paced the deck in silence, staring at the water and hoping for a miracle. When it finally came, three giant pink bubbles bursting at the surface off the starboard bow and ejecting Frank, Hazel, and Leo. Piper went a little crazy. She cried out with relief and dove straight into the water. What was she thinking? She didn't take a rope or a life vest or anything. But at the moment, she was just so happy that she paddled over to Leo and kissed him on the cheek, which kind of surprised him.
Miss me?
Leo laughed. Piper was suddenly furious.
Where were you? How are you guys alive?
Long story, he said.
A picnic basket bobbed to the surface next to him.
Want a brownie?
Once they got on board and changed into dry clothes, poor Frank had to borrow a pair of too small pants from Jason, the crew all gathered on the quarterdeck for a celebratory breakfast, except for Coach Hedge, who grumbled that the atmosphere was getting too cuddly for his tastes and went below to hammer out some dents in the hull. While Leo fussed over his helm controls, Hazel and Frank related the story of the fish centaurs and their training camp.
Incredible, Jason said. These are really good brownies.
That's your only comment? Piper demanded. He looked surprised.
What? I heard the story. Fish centaurs. Merpeople. Letter of intro to the Tiber River god.
Got it. But these brownies.
I know,
Frank said, his mouth full.
Try them with Esther's peach preserves.
That, Hazel said, is incredibly disgusting.
Pass me the jar, man.